Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, March 23rd, 2023. The CEO of TikTok tells a U.S. committee that the video app company is not an agent of China and is protecting American users' data from being accessed by the Chinese Communist Party via the TikTok's owner, the Chinese company ByteDance. But the House committee members of both parties, by and large, not agreeing with that, some calling for TikTok to be banned. We'll have portions of the hearing coming up in a moment. U.S. House voting on a veto override attempt of the first bill that President Joe Biden has ever vetoed. It blocks a Labor Department rule that allows retirement plan administrators to consider environmental, social, and governance issues, known as ESG, in their investment decisions. The House vote expected to come up short of the two-thirds vote required by the U.S. Constitution to override a presidential veto. House also starting a debate on a bill titled Parents' Bill of Rights, laying out specific rights that parents have when their children are in public schools, including reviewing curriculum and the list of books in the library and addressing the school board. President Biden celebrating the 13th anniversary of the Affordable Care Act, the health insurance law, and in doing so, criticizing House Republicans for their pressing for federal spending cuts to accompany a debt limit increase later this year. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and General Mark Milley, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, testifying before a House Appropriations Subcommittee on the president's defense budget request for the next fiscal year, Russia's war in Ukraine, and U.S. competition with China. The defense secretary saying that Chinese leader Xi Jinping's recent visit to Russia sends a troubling message. And the Senate working on amendments to a bill that would repeal the Iraq War Authorizations of Use of Military Force, or AUMFs, the two of them from 1991 and 2002. This from Associated Press, U.S. lawmakers grilled the CEO of TikTok over data security and harmful content Thursday, responding skeptically during a tense committee hearing to his assurance that the hugely popular video sharing app prioritizes user safety and should not be banned. Zhao Zichu's testimony came at a crucial time for the company, which has acquired 150 million American users but is under increasing pressure from U.S. officials. TikTok and its parent company ByteDance have been swept up in a wider geopolitical battle between Beijing and Washington over trade and technology. That from AP. C-SPAN covered the entire hearing. You can find the video at cspan.org. In his opening statement to the House Energy and Commerce Committee, TikTok CEO said that his company is not controlled by the Chinese Communist Party and takes data security very seriously.
Let me start by addressing a few misconceptions about ByteDance, of which we are a subsidiary. ByteDance is not owned or controlled by the Chinese government. It's a private company. 60% of the company is owned by global institutional investors. 20% is owned by the founder, and 20% owned by employees around the world. ByteDance has 5 board members. 3 of them are American. Now, TikTok itself is not available in mainland China. We're headquartered in Los Angeles and in Singapore, and we have 7,000 employees in the U.S. today. Still, we have heard important concerns about the potential for unwanted foreign access to U.S. data and potential manipulation of the TikTok U.S. ecosystem. Our approach has never been to dismiss or trivialize any of these concerns. We have addressed them with real action. Now, that's what we've been doing for the last 2 years, building what amounts to a firewall that seals off protected U.S. user data from unauthorized foreign access. The bottom line is this: American data stored on American soil by an American company overseen by American personnel. We call this initiative Project Texas. That's where Oracle is headquartered. Today, U.S. TikTok data is stored by default in Oracle servers. Only vetted personnel operating in a new company called TikTok U.S. Data Security can control access to this data. Now, additionally, we have plans for this company to report to an independent American board with strong security credentials. Now, there's still some work to do. We have legacy U.S. data sitting in our servers in Virginia and in Singapore. We're deleting those, and we expect that to be complete this year. When that is done, all protected U.S. data will be under the protection of U.S. law and under the control of the U.S.-led security team. This eliminates the concern that some of you have shared with me that TikTok user data can be subject to Chinese law. This goes further, by the way, than what any other company in our industry have done.
TikTok CEO Shou Zi Chu giving an opening statement at today's House Energy and Commerce Committee hearing in Washington, D.C. After that, for the next several hours, he fielded questions from committee members who, both Republican and Democrat, challenged those assertions about the extent of Chinese Communist Party control of the video app and the potential for misuse of users' data. It started with the chair, Kathy McMorris Rogers, Republican from Washington State.
TikTok has told us that you weren't sharing data with the CCP, but leaked audio from within TikTok has proven otherwise. TikTok told us that you weren't tracking the geolocation of American citizens. You were. TikTok told us you weren't spying on journalists. You were. In your testimony, you state that ByteDance is not beholden to the CCP. Again, each of the individuals I listed are affiliated with the Chinese Communist Party, including Zhang Fuping, who is reported to be the Communist Party secretary of ByteDance, and who has called for the party committee to, quote, take the lead across all party lines to ensure the algorithm is enforced by, quote, correct political direction. Just this morning, the Wall Street Journal reported that the CCP is opposed to a forced sale of TikTok by ByteDance, quoting a CCP spokesman as saying the Chinese government would make a decision regarding any sale of TikTok. So the CCP believes they have the final say over your company. I have zero confidence in your assertion that ByteDance and TikTok are not beholden to the CCP. Next question. Heeding content is a way of promoting and moderating content. In your current or previous positions within Chinese companies, have employees engaged in heeding content for users outside of China? Very quickly, yes or no?
Our heeding process is approved by our local teams in the various countries.
The answer is yes, thank you. Have any moderation tools been used to remove content on TikTok associated with the Uyghur genocide? Yes or no?
We do not remove that kind of content. TikTok is a place for freedom of expression. And Chair Rogers, like I said, if you use our app, you can go on it and you will see a lot of users around the world expressing content on that topic and many others.
Thank you. What about the massacre in Tiananmen Square, yes or no?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
The massacre in Tiananmen Square.
That kind of content is available on our platform. You can go and search it.
I will remind you that making false or misleading statements to Congress is a federal crime.
I understand. If you go on our platform,
you
will find that content.
Okay, thank you. Reclaiming my time, can you say with 100% certainty that ByteDance or the CCP cannot use your company or its divisions to heed content to promote pro-CCP messages for an act of aggression against Taiwan?
We do not promote or remove content at the request of the Chinese government.
The question is, are you 100% certain that they cannot use your company to promote such messages?
It is our commitment to this committee and all our users that we will keep this free from any manipulation by any government.
If you can't say 100% certain, I take that as a no. As I previously referenced, TikTok spied on American journalists. Can you say with 100% certainty that neither ByteDance nor TikTok employees can target other Americans with similar surveillance techniques?
Chair Rogers, I first of all disagree with the characterization that is spying. It was an internal investigation.
Yes or no? Can you do surveillance of other Americans?
We will protect the U.S. user data and fire it all from all unwanted foreign access. It's a commitment that we've given to the committee.
So I guess my question is, I wanted to hear you say with 100% certainty that neither ByteDance nor TikTok employees can target other Americans with similar surveillance techniques as you did with the journalist.
Again, I don't disagree with the characterization in surveillance, and we have given our commitments, Chair Rogers, the four commitments. I think it's our commitment that we will not be influenced by any government on these issues.
DOJ is investigating this surveillance right now. To the American people watching today, hear this. TikTok is a weapon by the Chinese Communist Party to spy on you, manipulate what you see, and exploit for future generations. A ban is only a short-term way to address TikTok, and a data privacy bill is the only way to stop TikTok from ever happening again in the United States.
Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers, Republican from Washington State, Chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee, questioning the TikTok CEO, Shou Zi Chu, at today's hearing. New York Times reports to continue operating in the United States under ByteDance's ownership, TikTok has sought approval from a group of federal agencies known as the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, or CFIUS, for a plan called Project Texas. That plan outlines how TikTok will prevent the Chinese government from having access to user data or meddling with content recommendations with oversight from government-approved officials and third-party auditors. The plan has not been approved. Last week, it emerged that the Biden administration wants TikTok's Chinese ownership to sell the app or face a possible ban. China said on Thursday that it would firmly oppose a forced sale of TikTok. A Commerce Ministry spokeswoman said at a news conference that such a sale would seriously undermine the confidence of investors from various countries, including China, to invest in the United States. That from the New York Times. More from today's hearing, Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, Democrat from California, questioning the CEO, Shou Zichu.
Now, under Beijing's security laws, Article 7 compels companies to provide data. Article 10 makes the reach of the law extraterritorial. Now, this is very clear. I don't need to read all of it into the record. But those are the laws of the PRC. How do you convince the Congress of the United States that there can be a clean break? Why would the Chinese government sidestep their national law, including Article 7, Article 10, in terms of user data?
Congressman, thank you for the question. I'm glad you asked this. As I said in the opening statement, our plan is to move American data to be stored on American soil by the American company.
I understand that. But you're sidestepping, or I haven't read anything in terms of TikTok, how you can actually say, and you spoke in your opening statement about a firewall relative to the data. But the Chinese government has that data. How can you promise that that will move into the United States of America and be protected here?
Congressman, I have seen no evidence that the Chinese government has access to that data. They have never asked us. We have not provided.
Well, you know what? I find that actually preposterous.
I have looked and I have seen no evidence of this happening. Mm. And in order to assure everybody here and all our users, our commitment is to move their data into the United States to be stored on American soil by an American company, overseen by American personnel. So the risk will be similar to any government going to an American company asking for data.
I'm one that doesn't believe that there is really a private sector in China.
Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, Democrat from California, questioning the CEO of TikTok, Shou Zichu, at today's House Energy and Commerce Committee hearing. Again, find the full hearing at our website at cspan.org. Some more news on TikTok, this from Forbes. A trio of American technology giants could tack on some $431 billion in market value if the U.S. bans TikTok, according to a Bernstein analysis published Thursday. As the issues posed by the wildly popular Chinese-owned social media app take center stage in Washington, those three companies, by the way, Alphabet, Meta, and Snap, each of which operate short-form video platforms that rival TikTok. And this from Reuters, Britain's parliament will block TikTok on all devices on its network, following a similar ban on government devices, becoming the latest Western institution to bar the Chinese-owned video app over security concerns. The U.S. House today began work on a bill that's titled the Parents' Bill of Rights. It would give parents with children in publicly funded school specific rights, including reviewing school curriculum and teaching materials, the school budget, and the list of books and materials in the school library, also the right to speak to the school board, to be informed of any violent activity at the school, and to meet with teachers twice a year. Speaking in favor of this bill on the House floor, Congresswoman Virginia Fox, Republican from North Carolina, chair of the Education and Labor Committee.
Over the past several years, parents witnessed the consequences of lessons taught in classrooms firsthand. Math scores declined by the largest margin ever, and reading scores plummeted to the lowest levels in over three decades. These results are devastating. Teachers' unions and education bureaucrats worked to push progressive politics in classrooms while keeping parents in the dark. The Parents' Bill of Rights Act aims to end that and shine a light on what is happening in schools. This bill will reaffirm a parent's right to review course curriculum, meet with the child's teacher, and be heard at school board meetings without fear of reprisal. My colleagues on the other side of the aisle seem convinced Republicans are using this bill to punish teachers or push an extreme right-wing agenda. This is false. Our education system is spiraling out of control as parents are pushed further outside of the classroom. This bill will restore the role of parents in schools and provide new mechanisms to promote parent-teacher partnerships. When parents are involved in their child's education, students thrive.
Congresswoman Virginia Fox, a Republican and chair of the Education and Labor Committee on the House floor, speaking in opposition to this bill, Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, Democrat from Florida.
There has been a movement to eliminate public education since the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision. With the election of our president 7 years ago, it pulled the scab off a wound that never healed. Now it is an open, gaping wound, and it is out of control. They are throwing everything at public schools but the kitchen sink, vouchers, excessive testing, poorly paid teachers, banning books, and now they're trying to drive a wedge and create an antagonistic relationship between schools and their parents. How pathetic, how dreadful. Parents love teachers. Everybody loves teachers. Every parent has an I love and remember a teacher story. How disgraceful. We want to terrorize the very people who love our children, keep them safe, and educate them for over 8 hours daily. Our teachers are sacrificial lambs. You will never eliminate public schools. We will fight you as long as it takes. This is all the little children who look like me have. Public schools are the bedrock of this nation.
Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, Democrat, on the House floor during the general debate on this bill dealing with parental oversight of K through 12 public schools. Many amendments are being offered, being voted on today and into tomorrow, and a final vote on the bill expected in the House on Friday. But even if it passes the House, today the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, saying he will not bring it up in the Senate for debate or vote.
As we speak, House Republicans are considering a sweeping piece of legislation that would nationalize school policy, endanger billions in nutrition funding, and accelerate the trend of book bans across the nation. The House Republican school control bill is Orwellian to the core, and it will not see the light of day here in the Senate. If passed, schools across the nation would be forced to adhere to a panoply of federal regulations that take power away from parents and school districts. Again, let me repeat that. It would take power away from parents and school districts, away from educators, and put it in the hand of elected politicians. Again, the GOP that treasured small government, local control, is long since gone.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, today on the Senate floor. The White House Office of Management and Budget has put out a statement of administrative policy opposing this bill from the House Republicans. It reads, in part, the administration does not support H.R. 5 in its current form because the bill does not actually help parents support their children at school. Moreover, instead of making LGBTQI plus students feel included in their school community, it puts them at higher risk. From the Washington Post, the White House is using the 13th anniversary of the Affordable Care Act to spotlight what the spending plans of House Republicans could mean for President Barack Obama's signature domestic initiative and other federal health care programs. In a release sent to reporters, the White House included 51 fact sheets, one for each state, plus one for the District of Columbia, detailing what could happen if Republicans, quote, are successful in repealing the Affordable Care Act and gutting Medicaid. President Biden speaking about this at the White House today.
There are nearly 40 million Americans in this country who get their health care through the Affordable Care Act and the Medicaid expansion. 40 million people have some peace of mind. The Affordable Care Act has been law for 13 years. It has developed deep roots in this country. It has become a critical part of providing health care and saving lives. We always talk about the cost, but it saves lives as well. Obviously, it doesn't mean much to our Republican friends, but it can be a matter of life and death to millions of Americans out there if they didn't have it. Even now, mega Republicans in Congress are intent on repealing the Affordable Care Act when it's clear it would have a devastating impact on the American people. We still haven't seen the House Republican budget. They want to negotiate. I say, I've laid down my budget tonight. You lay down yours. Let's negotiate. I don't know where their budget is. No, I'm serious. There has been no budget. As my brother would say, go figure. But look, the budgets are going to show what they value. A former Trump director of budget advising the MAGA Republicans in Congress has a plan to slash $2 trillion from Medicaid. I guess that shows a little bit of their value set. He wants to end Medicare expansion under the Affordable Care Act and make additional deep cuts that could lead to nearly 70 million people losing critical services. 70 million people. Most of them are seniors, people with disabilities, and with children. And children, I should say. And some could lose their health care altogether.
President Biden at the White House today, a celebration of the 13th anniversary of the Affordable Care Act, or ACA, also known as Obamacare. President mentioned that the House Republican leadership has not released a formal budget plan of their own this year, although Speaker Kevin McCarthy has said that spending reductions should be part of raising the national debt ceiling, which will be needed later this year to avoid a default. A subset of House Republicans, though, known as the Freedom Caucus, has released a spending cut plan. On Wednesday, some of their members held a news conference along with a Senate supporter, Republican Rick Scott of Florida.
Here's what I'm appreciative about the Freedom Caucus. They have put out their ideas, right? And there, if you think about it, there's two things we have to do. We have to say we're going to make some structural changes because up here, if we don't change, this is never going to get better. I've been up here 4 years. It's getting worse. The deficits are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So two things. One, what they've done is they said, here's some ideas that we can do, and let's have a conversation. On top of this, they said, these are some ways, this is some areas where we can take some money back and save some money. Why don't we have a conversation about that? Who am I disappointed with? Joe Biden, Chuck Schumer. They don't even want to have a conversation. So this is wrong. So I'm very optimistic with what the Freedom Caucus has done. We have a great opportunity to start the process of doing what every family in this country does, businesses do, is living within our means.
Senator Rick Scott, Republican from Florida, with members of the House Freedom Caucus at a news conference on Wednesday. Some of the caucus proposals are to repeal parts of last year's Inflation Reduction Act, cancel the $400 billion college student loan debt relief plan from the president, and limit non-defense discretionary spending to fiscal year 2022 levels for the next decade, which the caucus says would save $3 trillion. On Wall Street today, the Dow up 75, NASDAQ up 117, S&P up 11. An article at thehill.com, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, Democrat, called demands from House Republican leaders to force his testimony an unlawful incursion on his ongoing probe into former President Trump's role in a hush money scandal. The Thursday response from Alvin Bragg comes as lawmakers led by House Judiciary Committee Chair Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, demanded the DA turn over all documents and communications about the case. The move, Alvin Bragg wrote, is an unprecedented inquiry into a pending local prosecution. The letter only came after Donald Trump created a false expectation that he would be arrested the next day, and his lawyers reportedly urged you to intervene. That reporting from The Hill. One of the House Republican leaders, besides Jim Jordan, that sent this letter, James Comer of Kentucky, chair of the Oversight and Accountability Committee, he was on Fox News Wednesday night.
It's a misdemeanor they're trying to try as a felony. This is a local attorney. He's trying to base this on federal election law. That's two levels of government above where he's supposed to be prosecuting. I mean, the witnesses, you've got a disbarred attorney, a former porn star. I mean, the list goes on and on and on here, Liz. I mean, this is clearly not something that the Manhattan DA should be involved with. This could open up a can of worms. Who's to say that local attorneys in Kentucky would start going after Joe Biden for influence peddling? I mean, this is not something that the Manhattan DA should be involved in. That's why Congress has asked for him to come explain to us what he's doing. We have oversight anywhere where we have legislative purview, and we certainly write the election laws in Congress, not the election laws are not written by the Manhattan DA.
Congressman James Comer, chair of the Oversight Committee, Republican from Kentucky, on Fox News Wednesday night, talking about the letter that he and the chairs of the Judiciary Committee and the House Administration Committee sent to the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, demanding their testimony and documents in the Donald Trump case there. And today, Alvin Bragg sending back his own letter saying basically no. Congressman Glenn Ivey, Democrat from Maryland, a member of the Judiciary Committee, agreed in a news conference today.
I was astonished, actually, when I saw the letter from the three committee chairs to Mr. Bragg, essentially calling on him to violate grand jury secrecy laws in New York, which, of course, is a felony. He rightly declined to do that. My call was for those three to withdraw the letter immediately, hopefully recognizing the mistake that they had made, but that's too much to ask, I suppose. But I think it's important to let the process play out, as Congressman Liu was just suggesting. We don't know what the grand jury is going to do in New York. I think we just have to wait and see. But that's how the process is supposed to work, whether you're a former president or just a regular person on the street under investigation. Let's let it run its course according to the law.
Congressman Glenn Ivey, Democrat, at a news conference today with other House Democrats. Manhattan grand jury did not hear evidence in the Donald Trump case today. Their next meeting is Monday. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you get your podcasts. A story from the Associated Press, the U.S. military must be ready for possible confrontation with China, the Pentagon's leaders said Thursday, pushing Congress to approve the Defense Department's proposed $842 billion budget, which would modernize the force in Asia and around the world. Those Pentagon leaders are the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and General Mark Milley, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who testified before the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense. We covered it on C-SPAN. Congressman Hal Rogers, Republican from Kentucky, asking the witnesses about, again, this is how the AP article put it, Chinese leader Xi Jinping's visit to Moscow, which added to concerns that China will step up its support for Russian President Vladimir Putin's war on Ukraine and increasingly threaten the West.
Let me bring up a topic that's the elephant in the room, and that's competition with China. How do you assess the Chinese president's visit to Moscow recently? And how does that play in the larger world stage on our competition with China? Mr. Secretary?
I'll begin, sir, and then certainly offer the chairman, with your permission, a chance to comment. It's troubling to see that. Putin attacked his neighbor in an unprecedented way and seeks to change the border and access his neighbor's property or sovereign territory. So Xi's visit to Putin, and remaining there for a couple of days, I think sends a very troubling message, a message of support. We don't see them providing any material support to Russia right now, but we're watching this very, very closely. If they were to go down that path, I think it would be very troubling for the international community. But certainly just showing support by his presence there, I think, is very troubling. I think that, you know, it's been described as a marriage of convenience. You know, Putin doesn't have any allies or partners that he can turn to in the international community. And so China is willing to continue to develop that relationship. That's very, very interesting. But it's troubling that, you know, what we've seen. Again, it will be even more troubling if she decides to provide material support to Russia. It would prolong the conflict and certainly broaden the conflict potentially, not only in the region, but globally.
General?
So, Congressman Rogers, thanks for the question. China is a serious, probably the most serious, geostrategic adversary the United States is facing today and will be facing through mid-century and perhaps the entire century. And if you were a historian in the year, a century from now, the story of this century will likely be, the geostrategic story is going to likely be, what was the relationship between the United States and China? Did it end up in a war or not? And I think that we need to be really careful as we go forward to make sure that our military and our capabilities are way stronger than anything China can field. That's fundamental to deterrence. We don't want a great power war with China. We want to prevent that. And the way to prevent it is a strong, powerful military, a demonstrated will to use it if necessary, and that they clearly and unambiguously understand it. What we see in China, what we see in terms of a nation state, over the last 40-plus years, since Deng Xiaoping introduced his reforms in 1979, is an enormous growth in wealth, the greatest growth in wealth of any country, to include all the United States back in the 1800s. This is an enormous growth in wealth, an enormous shift in power globally. And in the wake of that wealth is coming this military. Their military has advanced from a peasant-based infantry army in 1979 to a world-class military that is a near peer of the United States. They are not better than we are. They have a long way to go for that. But they are closing the gap very, very quickly. It is incumbent upon us to make sure that we remain number one at all times. That will help keep the peace. If we somehow fall behind, that'll become very dangerous, in my opinion.
So the goal, sir, is to deter China from making an ill-advised decision going forward. And you've heard me say a number of times that I don't think a military action against Taiwan is either imminent or unavoidable. I think that the way that we keep things in the right place is to make sure that we're able to talk to each other. You've seen me reach out a number of times to my counterpart. I'll continue to do that. I think military leaders should be able to talk to each other, to manage escalation, and to determine intent, and a number of other things. But I think this communication is really, really important. So, I do not think that military action is imminent. But certainly, as the chairman pointed out, we have to make sure that we remain a combat-credible force, and we'll do everything within our power to make sure we do that.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and General Mark Milley, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, testifying before the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense about the fiscal year 2023 budget request for the Pentagon. Questions coming from Congressman Howard Rogers, Republican. CNN reports the estimated cost of reconstruction efforts in Ukraine after Russia's invasion has reached $411 billion, according to an updated assessment by the World Bank. This amounts to 2.6 times the country's estimated gross domestic product in 2022. Secretary of State Antony Blinken before the House Foreign Affairs Committee today, talking about the budget for the State Department and foreign operations for the next fiscal year. Reuters reports that the Republican chairman of the committee gave the State Department until Monday to produce documents related to the August 2021 U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan or face a subpoena. The Reuters article goes on to say that Congressman Michael McCaul, Republican from Texas, the committee chair, has launched an investigation into the messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and events in the country since. Republicans and some Democrats say there's never been a full accounting of the chaotic operation in which 13 U.S. service members were killed at Kabul's airport. Here's some of the exchange between the chairman and Secretary Blinken, and one of the documents requested is called a dissent cable.
But we need this dissent cable, and I think the American people deserve to see it, to know what in the world was going on in those critical weeks, especially after the testimony of Sergeant Tyler Vargas Anders. He deserves to know. Christy Shamblin deserves to know what the dissent was. I have the subpoena. It's right here. And I'm prepared to serve this. Now, we've had discussions, and I think, you know, as a former federal prosecutor, you want to work things out, but when you can't, you have to go forward with a subpoena, an arrest warrant, an indictment. So, sir, I'm going to give you until the close of business on Monday to produce that dissent cable to this committee and this Congress, so the American people can see what the employees at the embassy in Kabul were thinking about your policy that they dissented from. Do you have any response?
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And first, I want to make clear that we are working to provide all the information that this committee is looking for. And that its oversight responsibilities give it the authority to secure. And as you noted, we just produced the embassy action plan, thousands of pages that go along with that. We're committed to making available and sharing the substance of the after-action review within the next 3 weeks. And you heard that from the White House. And as to the sent channel cable, I appreciate everything you're saying. And let me just put this very briefly in perspective for members of the committee who may not follow this. This tradition of having a dissent channel is one that is cherished in the department and goes back decades. It's a unique way for anyone in the department to speak truth to power as they see it without fear or favor. And they do it by the regulations we established for these cables in a privileged and confidential way. It is vital to me that we preserve the integrity of that process and of that channel, that we not take any steps that could have a chilling effect on the willingness of others to come forward in the future to express dissenting views on the policies that are being pursued.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken, questioned by Congressman Michael McCaul, Republican from Texas, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee at today's hearing. The secretary went on to say that he'd be willing to support a redacted version of the dissent cable dealing with Afghanistan to be provided to Congress. U.S. Senate continuing work on a bill that would repeal the Iraq War's authorizations of the use of military force, AUMFs, the two from 1991 and 2002. Several amendments have been voted on. They started Wednesday night and went into today, none passing, including an amendment from Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky. It would repeal, in addition, the 2001 AUMF, that dealt with the invasion of Afghanistan and the fight against terrorism, an authority that is still in use today to justify U.S. military action against other terror groups, al-Qaeda, ISIS, al-Shabaab. Here is Senator Rand Paul from Wednesday night.
The wording of the 9/11 AUMF was debated in 2001, a generation ago, and was precisely worded to authorize the president to make war on those who attacked us on 9/11 and those who harbored them. Not a word about making war on associated forces, not a word about making war on their descendants, not a word about making worldwide war on religious extremism. But that's exactly what the 9/11-2001 AUMF has become, a catch-all for permanent war everywhere, all the time. So if anyone in the Senate is really serious about regaining the power to declare war, about informing presidents of both parties that the Constitution exclusively gave the power to declare war to Congress. I offer an amendment today that might actually bring an American soldier home, an amendment that might actually save an American soldier's life, an amendment that sends an actual signal to the president that congressional authority and resolve actually lives and breathes and will resist presidential aggrandizement. Some senators will argue that a vote to repeal the 9/11 military force proclamation for war, but they say, well, we could do it, but only if we simultaneously replace it with another sweeping transfer of war-making power to future presidents. Really? Is there not one defender of Congress's exclusive power to declare war? Is there no one else who will reject the abdication of Congress to constitutional responsibilities? Is there not anyone who will defend the notion that absent a perpetual authorization for war, we could survive on just the Constitution alone?
Senator Rand Paul, Republican, offering his amendment Wednesday night on the Senate floor. Again, the underlying bill repeals the Iraq and the Gulf War AUMFs from 1991 and 2002. His amendment would also repeal the 2001 post-9/11 AUMF. Senator Bob Menendez, Democrat from New Jersey, chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, opposing it.
I welcome a broader discussion on the 2001 authorization for the use of military force, but that is not before us today. Following repeal of the 1991 and 2002 AUMFs, I hope that we can engage in what will likely be a robust debate about what authorities the administration does need and what the scope potentially of a replacement AUMF would be. But as yet, we have not had that substantive discussion. And I don't believe it would be wise to repeal the 2001 AUMF without engaging in that debate first, without having the hearings to understand what is the authorities the administration needs to continue to protect America. The details matter here. We just finished a hearing at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee with the Secretary of State. He testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the 2001 AUMF is still a vital authority that is being relied on. So we may disagree with how the 2001 AUMF has been maybe stretched by other executive branches and concerns as to how we will continue to use it, but an outright repeal with nothing to replace it, nothing to replace it, is not a sound response that ensures our military has what it needs to execute missions in defense of U.S. interests.
Senator Bob Menendez, Democrat from New Jersey, chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, on the Senate floor Wednesday night, opposing Senator Rand Paul's amendment. The Paul amendment did fail by a vote of 9 yes and 86 no. Amendment votes continue today. One offered by Senator Mike Lee, a Republican from Utah, would sunset all future AUMFs after 2 years. That also failed, 19-79. Another one from Senator Marco Rubio, Republican from Florida, would require, before the Iraq War AUMFs were repealed, that the president certify that Iran has stopped aiding terror groups in Iraq and Syria. That was defeated 32-63. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announcing that a cloture vote to bring debate to an end on the underlying bill will happen on Monday. 60 votes will be needed for that. And at that time, additional amendments may be voted on, and then it's on to final passage. As always, you can follow the Senate live on C-SPAN 2 television. The House is live on C-SPAN, or listen to them both on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. U.S. House today voting on a veto override attempt, the first veto of President Biden's presidency. It was a bill to block a Labor Department rule allowing retirement fund managers to take into account ESG in their investment decisions. That's environmental, social, and governance issues. Some debate before the House vote. Here is Congresswoman Virginia Fox, Republican from North Carolina. She chairs the committee that handled this.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I rise in support of overriding President Biden's veto of H.J. Res 30, a Congressional Review Act resolution nullifying the Biden administration's attempt to politicize the retirement savings of Americans. This is deja vu for the American people. With his veto, the president once again insists
on undermining the financial security of the very people who elected him. Republicans will stand with American workers and retirees in protecting their savings. ESG investing puts the future of millions of Americans in jeopardy when they are already facing economic hardships and inflation brought on by this administration's reckless spending. The president says HJ Res 30 would make it, quote, illegal to consider risk factors. But that statement is blatantly false and misleading.
Congresswoman Virginia Fox, Republican, who chairs the Education and Labor Committee on the House floor today, opposing the veto override. Congressman Bobby Scott, Democrat from Virginia, ranking member on the committee.
Gentleman is recognized.
Madam Speaker, I rise in opposition to the House Republican majority's effort to override President Biden's veto message on President Biden's veto of HJ Res 30. This resolution sought to nullify a popular and sensible rule that enabled retirement plan managers to make fully informed investment decisions. I commend the president for his veto. Workers should be able to invest their retirement savings in a way that reflects their values, such as combating climate change, without sacrificing investment returns. That's why the Biden-Harris administration issued a rule to clarify that retirement plan managers may consider the economic effect of climate change and other environmental, social, and governance factors, or ESG factors, when they make investment decisions for participants in retirement plans. Simply put, this rule is not an ESG mandate. It just allows participants to make those decisions.
Congressman Bobby Scott, Democrat on the House floor. The House not expected to have the two-thirds vote needed under the Constitution to override the president's veto, and so the Senate will not be needing to take a vote on an override attempt. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Get the stories Washington is talking about sent to you every day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.